Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. We have the privilege each week of picking the intelligence of one of our regulars. His name is Bill Walton. He formerly served as a master of the universe on Wall Street and has become a master of the conservative movement and a thought leader in many respects in connection with the great work he does at his Bill Walton Show television podcast. I commend it to all of you. Bill, it's good to have you with us. Welcome back.
Thanks, Frank. Great, as usual. Great talking with you.
A lot to talk about. Let's start with a hardy perennial of this program now, unfortunately, because it continues to be a real and present danger, namely SR1, known as HR1 in the House, legislation that I think would finish off free and fair elections. It had a markup last week in the Senate Rules Committee. It did not go well for the proponents of this legislation. Tell us a little bit about where things stand at the moment, and particularly the possibility that it may come about in a different form, a kind of bait and switch legislatively.
Well, if you want to be proud of our Republican senators, you should witness how they performed last week in the markup session. Item after item after item, they successfully raised issues with, and it was an ugly session if you were for SR1, which of course we are not. So what's happened is that they've come up with another idea, which would be even in most cases, more pernicious, which is they've come up with another bill that they're calling the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act. And it's very simple. It's a very simple little bill in this sense. It gives the federal Justice Department, the U.S. Justice Department, in effect, control over any change or any aspect of state and local elections. So instead of a 200,000 word SR1, it's a much shorter bill, but it goes right to the juggler. And of course, if you're Eric Holder, he was the one that radicalized the Justice Department most effectively. Most of those people are still there during the Obama years, and most of those people didn't leave the building when Trump was in office, and so they're still there. And
yes, as we learned to our great horror.
Yeah, and they've added more people, like-minded people, and so this would be a catastrophe for our election process. And they've been very clever. They've named it after civil rights activist John Lewis, and of course he's among the sainted few. But I think it's more accurately should be called the Eric Holder Voting Rights Act, because that's really what they're doing.
Yeah. And were they to do it, it would give them essentially the ability to put into place all of the voting regulations and mechanisms and procedures that they were going to try to enact, but have now been caught at and exposed for trying to do.
Yeah, and it brings back a piece of what was in the 1965 Voting Rights Act, something called Section 5. And of course, then the concern was that the Southern states were not going to be towing the line on the law, and that
with respect to free and fair voting for minorities.
And so they effectively put them under supervision, and many of the Southern states were under Section 5, which gave the Justice Department oversight. And maybe that was appropriate at the time, but I think in 2006, the Supreme Court ruled that this needed to go away, and because 2006 was no longer 1965. And you know, the United States now probably has voters have an easier time registering today and voting at any time in our nation's history. So this is a solution.
Too easy, some may say, because some are actually not entitled to vote, citizens and the like. Bill, this is such an important point. Beware the bait and switch. Beware, you know, the Trojan horse, in effect, of the John Lewis Civil Rights or Voting Rights Act. It really is something that bears exactly the same close scrutiny and opposition that HR1, S1 have received to date. And thank you for your leadership in in bringing that about. I trust it will continue to be brought to bear. Let me turn to another topic, Bill, taking advantage of your experience with Wall Street and, you know, finance more generally. Inflation, or some say stagflation, is rearing its ugly head at the moment. What's going on in that regard, and how serious a threat is it to our economic and, well, social fabric?
Well, I think it's a serious threat. We've seen the federal government pile trillions of dollars into the economy, and in many cases this money's coming in supposedly to help people with the COVID lockdown with these relief checks, and most of the two-thirds of the relief checks have been sent out after all the signs that the economy was recovering and the jobs were rising sharply. Now we find ourselves in a position where consumer spending is way up, construction's booming, we've got labor shortages. In other words, it's exhibit A, B, C, D, and on and on and on, that we are not a hot economy. And normally the Federal Reserve would step in and what they used to say, take away the punch bowl so the party doesn't get any livelier. They're not doing that now. They're bringing out punch bowl after punch bowl after punch bowl. And one of the alarming things about the Fed is that their progressive tendencies not only extend to monetary policy, but they've gotten into the racial equity, social justice, and environmental climate change business. Just last year.
How is that manifesting itself, Bill? I'm not familiar with how that ties into the Fed's responsibility.
Well, I'm dating myself, but I used to think the Fed was responsible for price changes and a stable dollar. The Congress added employment as a dual mandate a couple of years, many years ago. But since then, the Fed on its own has added this social justice agendas. To give you an example, the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago last June put out something titled Racial Equity Primer. And what it says is that racial equity is central to the San Francisco Fed's mission, and they can't ignore racial inequities in monetary policy. Now, how you go from monetary policy to solving all the social issues that they perceive is mystifying. And of course, they can't. I mean, it's an absurd objective for a Federal Reserve to be talking about. Pat Toomey, our senator from Pennsylvania, has written some strongly worded letters to the Federal Reserve on these issues, not just to the one in Washington, but all the 12 banks, because they're all engaged in the same mission creep, promoting a social agenda. So he's on it, but I'm not sure that that's going to have much effect.
Yeah, unfortunately, it's more than studies. It sounds like it's actually shaping policy in ways that could be quite inimical. Bill Walton, we have to leave it at that, but this is a topic to which we'll return next week, because I have the feeling that the problem that you've identified is likely to grow.
I've got one more fact that I want to leave. I want to leave with one more fact. In 20 years, almost 30% of the federal budget's going to be going to paying back the interest on the federal debt that's been incurred in the last couple of years. We've got a looming problem that we've got to do something about.
It sounds to me as though we may be on a much shorter timeline than that, and the damage done to, among other things, our national security by virtue of not having the funds with which to pay for our military is a distinct possibility here. Bill Walton, we have to leave it at that. Thank you so much for your time today. Come back to us again next week. Look forward to it greatly. Next up, we will speak with Gordon Chang about what is afoot with this Korean summit with Moon Jae-in, and more right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back, and a special welcome to one of our wonderful featured guests here at Secure Freedom Radio, the great Gordon Chang. He is, of course, our duty expert and that of much of the free world on communist China and what it is about and what the implications are of all of that, both in the region and far beyond. He is the author of a number of important books, including The Coming Collapse of China and The Great U.S.-China Tech War. He is also a featured columnist these days for the Newsweek and Gatestone Institute outlets. He is a man that you should follow, as do I, at Gordon G. Chang on Twitter. Gordon, it's good to have you back in the house virtually. Welcome.
Well, thank you so much, Frank.
Well, there's a lot going to be happening in your portfolio this week. We have Moon Jae-in, the president of South Korea, coming to Washington, and this has set the Biden team off on new policy prescriptions for North Korea. Tell us a little bit about Moon and the sort of thesis that you addressed in one of your other terrific books, Losing South Korea, which seems to be in prospect under his administration.
Well, Moon is in the next to last year of his administration, and he's done everything that he can to move South Korea away from the United States and into the orbit of both China and North Korea. Now, he says he's not a communist. He says he's not a North Korean agent. He says he's not a traitor. And I suppose we have to take him at his word. But if he were a North Korean agent, if he were a communist, if he were a traitor, he would be doing exactly what he is doing now. And it's only because last April 15th, his party did not win a 3/4 majority that South Korea is now not part of North Korea. Because if he had gotten that 3/4 majority, he would have been able to amend the South Korean constitution to unify with North Korea. And he would be willing to do it more or less on North Korea's terms. So we're very fortunate that he fell a few votes short a year ago.
Yeah. And there's reason to believe that that was on the basis of electoral fraud. Some say it was a kind of dress rehearsal for the Chinese with respect to some of the things that they subsequently contributed to here. But either way, it was a near run thing there. And as it is, he's still very much driving, I believe, the policy direction of South Korea in a manner that, as you say, is deeply problematic. Now, this has prompted the Biden administration to talk about a policy approach towards North Korea that presumably would be pretty much to the liking of Moon Jae-in. What do you expect will come of that policy shift by the Biden team and their conversations when they get together this week, Gordon?
We don't know exactly what the Biden policy will be because they were just very sketchy when Jen Psaki outlined it to reporters on Air Force One. But she did say it wasn't going to be strategic patience. In other words, it wasn't going to be like Obama's policy. And she also said it wasn't going to be a grand bargain, which is like Trump's policy. But she didn't say what it really was going to be. Although the administration did say that they consulted with South Korea as they formulated it, and they've also informed South Korea what they intend to do. Now, Moon arrives in the White House on Friday for a summit. It's Biden's second summit in the White House following Japan. South Korea is second. Nothing good can happen, really, because Moon Jae-in, when he comes in, is going to be trying to undermine peace and stability in the region. And so the best that can happen is that nothing happens. But clearly, this is going to be important for Moon, and that's the reason why he's making a trip halfway around the world to talk to Biden.
The administration did say, in the form of Jen Psaki, one other piece, and I just want to sort of tease that out with you, Gordon, because what you've said is really chilling. She said that there will be a focus on not only consultation with allies and partners at every step along the way with a focus on practical progress, but she also said that they would be working towards, quote, calibrated practical approach that is open to and will explore diplomacy, unquote. Now, that sounds to me as though we're in the bazaar and we will be making deals willy-nilly if the administration has its way. And that certainly would seem to be very much to the liking of Moon Jae-in, no?
Yes. Well, what hasn't been said, and this is we don't know what Biden will do, but there was no emphasis on sanctions enforcement, which I believe is the only real way forward for the U.S. And not only sanctions on North Korea, but also sanctions on China. Because unless you go after the source of the problem, you aren't going to solve the problem. So yeah, we have a North Korea problem, but it's really a China problem because China's been using North Korea as a weapon against South Korea, Japan, the United States. And we've seen this over the course of decades. And Trump sort of got out of this game. I don't agree with Trump's North Korea policy, but he did do some important things. And one of them was he wasn't going to be played by China anymore. Anthony Blinken, our Secretary of State, has just talked about a few things that suggest he is looking to China for a solution. And that really leads to no good outcomes for anybody except for China and North Korea.
And this isn't a hypothetical, Gordon. We've actually seen this movie repeatedly where the Chinese profess to be the arbiter of, you know, the future direction of North Korea. And if only we work with them and reward them, they will ensure that the North Koreans behave themselves. This has gotten us nowhere at best. And at worst, it's actually helped by time for Kim Jong-un and his predecessors to build up a very formidable nuclear capability that threatens not just the South Koreans, but arguably Japan and our forces there and perhaps beyond as well.
Oh, certainly it threatens Japan, and it certainly threatens the United States as well. And you're absolutely right. This has bought time for the North Korean regime. And China has not only bought time for the Kim family, they've also supplied the Kim family with money and technology and materials and parts for their various dangerous weapons program. So whenever you go—
ballistic missiles and nuclear capabilities among them.
Yes. And we have seen that every time you go to the UN to talk about North Korea, it's the Chinese, most often in connection with the Russians, supporting the North Koreans and arguing their case.
This is not a happy prospect that we will see more of the same or perhaps intensified progress in this ill-advised direction. But Gordon, let me turn, if I can, to another piece of diplomacy that is afoot at the moment. We'll be talking in the next two segments with some of our colleagues about what is befalling Israel at the hands of a terrorist organization known as Hamas and others in the Palestinian community that are currently working to, take down the Jewish state. I think there's no getting around it. China is the president of the Security Council of the United Nations at the moment, and they seem quite intent on using that seat to try to save Hamas, to impose a ceasefire on the Israelis that will have the effect of buying time again for people with whom they are aligned and very much to the detriment of our vital ally in that region, Israel. How do you see that playing out in the UN Security Council? And if you can, do you think that Xi's relationship with Biden, which I believe is deeply compromised, Joe, is likely to help encourage the United States to do what China wants and what would be very detrimental to the Israelis?
The Middle East was peace and secure under President Trump because of the Abraham Accords. I think the Palestinians saw President Biden as a big green light to attack Israel. And so therefore, I think we should be asking the Biden administration some serious questions about their policy, which seems to have caused all of this turmoil over the last 8 days. China's position has been to try to broker an agreement, to be the host of talks. But it's also said a couple of things in public which are crucial, because what basically Beijing has been saying is that the Palestinian cause is just. There should be a two-state solution. But we don't see it putting any pressure on the Hamas or, more importantly, Iran to recognize Israel's right to exist. And until they do that, a ceasefire is not in anyone's best interest except for bad actors. And indeed, we need to see China move very differently. And until we do that, we have to say that its statements are deeply cynical and injurious to the cause of peace. China is standing in the way of a durable solution.
Amen. In this area, as with North Korea, I think it's fair to say. Gordon, lastly, and very quickly, we will be talking in a moment with Sam Faddis about Tony Fauci's involvement with the Wuhan Institute of Virology, evidently actually enabling this gain-of-function experimentation that brought us, it appears, this so-called COVID virus. I call it the CCP virus. What is your take on all of this as it's being revealed to us seemingly day by day?
We have got to press Dr. Fauci. We've got to press the National Institutes of Health to get answers, because Fauci's Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, which is a part of NIH, did fund Echo Health Alliance, a New York NGO, which was funding gain-of-function research in the Wuhan Institute of Virology. Fauci's institute had to know what was going on. And so, you know, Fauci's answers to Rand Paul may have been factually correct, but they were misleading. And Rand Paul should have pressed him to answer some questions that Fauci evaded. So, yes, NIH did not fund the Wuhan Institute, but it did provide funding, which it knew would go to the Wuhan Institute. We know that there's gain of function there. And so Fauci was essentially funding China's biological weapons program, and he needs to be held to account for it. Unfortunately, we don't see that happening at this moment. So we got to press this from the bottom up, and we should ask Rand Paul to maybe ask better questions in the future.
I have every reason to believe he will when he gets the next chance. Gordon Chang, thank you for answering our questions so brilliantly, always doing so in a way that really illuminates the problems that we're facing on so many fronts, notably with the Chinese Communist Party. Keep up the great work you do, my friend, at the Gatestone Institute in Newsweek and elsewhere. Come back to us again very soon, if you would. Next up, we will be speaking with Colonel Richard Kemp, a veteran of a lot of the previous conflicts with Hamas, and more right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back, and a very special welcome to a man that I admire greatly, both for his longtime service, well, not just to his country, the United Kingdom, but to the free world, in the uniform of a British Army officer, but also that he has rendered since he took that uniform off. His name is Colonel Richard Kemp. He is the host, or star, I guess I should say, of a terrific short video by Prager University about the topic that we wanted to visit with him about urgently today in light of what is playing out in the Middle East at the moment, namely the multidimensional assault on the state of Israel, a country in which he has spent a lot of time, including in previous Gaza conflicts, and about which he speaks in this Prager University video. He has served with distinction in, among other places, Northern Ireland, Bosnia, Macedonia, Iraq, and commanded British forces in Afghanistan. He's an always welcome guest here, and we're delighted to have him back. Colonel, thank you for taking a few minutes on very short notice to visit with us about what's going on at the moment in Israel.
Thank you, Frank. It's a real pleasure, as always.
I wanted to get your sense as a veteran of previous horrific challenges Israel has faced in trying to deal with the threat from a terrorist organization that surrounds itself with human shields and uses the territory that it has in Gaza to attack Israel. To talk a bit about what's going on there at the moment and whether Israel is today, as in the past, exercising very remarkable and commendable restraint, even as it tries to contend with a mortal threat to its own people.
Well, Frank, the tactics used by Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad in Gaza will be very familiar to every person from the US forces, British Army, and our allies who have served in Iraq and Afghanistan. They're the same type of tactics. They use human shields. They do so to try and prevent our forces from counterattacking, and also when they do counterattack, because of course they inevitably have to, if innocent civilians do die, which again is unfortunately inevitable in this kind of conflict, then they use that in the media to isolate, in this case, to isolate and vilify Israel and to try and force a UN condemnation of Israel. I think the difference here is that in this case, in Afghanistan, it was thousands of miles away from either of our countries. In this case, they're right on Israel's doorstep, and Israel has no choice other than to act absolutely decisively in this conflict.
Yeah, and they are actually attacking across that doorstep into Israel itself, of course, with thousands now of rockets. When you look at some of the tactical decisions that the Israelis have been making in this most recent episode, notably attacking the tunnel complexes that the Hamas terrorists have used to both conceal their forces and move them about, and in some cases launch them against Israel. How would you characterize the measured force that's being used there and the effects?
Well, I think the tunnel attack you mentioned is a masterpiece of military planning and execution involving surprise, deception, and massive attack using 160 aircraft on a small target area in a very short space of time, under an hour. And that takes a huge amount of skill and ability and planning. And on top of all the different complexities involved with that, the IDF also took immense steps, as they do with all of their operations, to minimize the deaths of innocent civilians. And I think that operation will be studied by armed forces for years to come. And the same should apply also. And I know in the past, American Army and British Army have studied Israel's tactics for preventing the deaths of innocent civilians on the battlefield. I think they are world leaders at that for very good reason. They make phone calls to people in tower blocks or buildings that they're planning to attack, not just telling them to get out before they attack, but also telling them where to go to be safe and how to get there. Extraordinary. As well as various other measures like radio broadcasts, etc. And as a result, many, many civilian lives have been saved. Of course, some have been lost, because it's impossible not to kill innocent civilians in this type of situation.
Especially when the enemy goes to such lengths to ensure that you do. This brings me to a quick question, sir. The Israeli Defense Forces took out a building in which the Associated Press and a number of other outlets, Al Jazeera, I believe, and several media organizations operated from in Gaza. This is, of course, precipitated howls of outrage by the international media, and is, now being added to the litany of reasons why there must be an immediate ceasefire. First of all, talk about the AP building. And second, the advisability of heeding these calls, of having the United States now throw its weight behind efforts the Chinese and others have made to insist that Israel must, forego further military operations in Gaza.
I mean, first of all, on that building, the building housed a critical Hamas military center. And had to be taken out, and any army would have done that, even if the media were there.
Again, no accident that it was there, right?
Right. Well, of course, one has to ask the question about why international media would be co-locating themselves with Hamas. And if they claim they didn't know, why didn't they know? They're supposed to be investigating. So I think, I have very limited...
It strains credulity that they would be clueless about that, don't you think?
It strains credibility, yeah, absolutely. And of course, again, this wasn't an attack on the media. Israel warned the media and other innocents to get out of there. As for the advisability of pushing for a ceasefire, I think it would be a grave mistake for the US to try and force Israel to stop their operations against Hamas in Gaza now. Of course, countries like China and Russia and the EU and others will want that to happen. They will want to push out these sort of virtue signaling messages. But the US obviously can't just be brushed off if they pressure Israel. So the answer is they should not pressure Israel, because Israel has to be able to complete this operation until it has judged that the threat is gone. This is not just about fighting the current conflict. It's about preventing the next one. And of course, that's in everybody's interests. And it's only Israel can judge, at what that point comes. And other people, particularly responsible players like the US, should frankly not get involved in that kind of discussion, or certainly not in any public a statement about it.
It falls to this very uncertain trumpet of the Biden administration to hold the line and prevent UN Security Council measures from being taken and so on against Israel. I pray they will do that. I'm not confident of it, but I pray they will, because, as you say, Colonel Kemp, it is in America's interest as well as that of Israel. Let me turn from the Gaza conflict, if I can, Richard Kemp, to other theaters that you're familiar with, notably what's been happening on the Temple Mount. Again, it seems instigated not just by Hamas, but by the so-called moderates, Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian Authority. But also what is happening now in the nature of what are being described as pogroms by Israeli Arabs, citizens of the country, against their Jewish fellow citizens in cities, it seems, across the land.
Well, I think, you know, people often try and portray Mahmoud Abbas and Fatah and the Palestinian Authority as being moderates. They're not moderates. They want the same thing as Hamas, i.e. they want the annihilation of Israel. They don't want a two-state solution. They have different means to try and bring that about, but they share the same objective. And the proximate cause of violence on Temple Mount and in Jerusalem more widely was a failed election, an election that Mahmoud Abbas called years too late, but then recognized that he was going to lose the election and cancelled it and blamed Israel. And that was among other factors that led to the flare-up in Jerusalem.
Incitement, in other words.
As to the wider attacks across Israel by Israeli Arabs, again, these didn't happen by chance. It's the first time we've seen this in over two decades, despite other similar conflicts to what's going on in Gaza. This, again, is the result of infiltration by Hamas of Israeli Arab groups across the country who agitated and pressurized these attacks. And that they have their reasons, which include their desire to prevent Israeli Arabs from engaging in Israeli mainstream politics, which was on the cards. And also, we shouldn't forget that Hamas and Palestinians at Jihad are the proxies of Iran. And it's in Iran's interest to have instability in Israel and in Gaza.
Yeah, well, and my fear, and I'm sure it is yours too, sir, is that this is a prelude to Iran becoming even more aggressive, maybe through other proxies like Hezbollah in northern Israel, or its vast array of missiles that could be unleashed at any time against the Israelis. This is a fraught moment, and I fear that in no small measure it has been brought about by the policy approach and the personnel choices of the Biden administration. I pray they will, as I say, stay the course and stand by Israel. Never again must once again be our watchwords. Colonel Richard Kemp, thank you for joining us today, and thank you for your extraordinary service, not only to your own country and Her Majesty's government, but also to the rest of us in the free world, and for standing by Israel in these moments and helping clarify the valiant efforts that it is making to both protect its people and do so in the most humane manner possible. We appreciate you, sir. Come back to us again very soon, if you will. Next up, Sam Faddis joins us. We'll talk with him about the threat we're facing from Tony Fauci, among others, right after this.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. One of my personal heroes and a truly great American is former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. He's joining two of my Center for Security Policy colleagues, Fred Flights and David Wormser, tomorrow at 1:30 p.m. Eastern Time for an online webinar assessing Joe Biden's myriad national security failures. Please register to join us for this timely, in-depth discussion at securefreedom.org.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, and we're joined by one of our regulars, a feature of our program, I'm pleased to say. His name is Charles Sam Faddis. He is a former Army officer and undercover operative for the Central Intelligence Agency. He now, among other things, is the driving force behind a terrific online resource called And Magazine. You can check it out at andmagazine.com. Also, his books, both fiction and nonfiction, including one that unfortunately is all too nonfiction, The Decline and Fall of the CIA. The title is Beyond Repair. Sam Faddis, it's good to have you with us. Welcome back.
Great to be here, Frank. Thank you.
I wanted to talk to you about two things that you've written about recently at And Magazine. The first, very much timely in light of what we were listening to a moment ago with Colonel Richard Kemp, namely what the Biden administration has done to date and may yet do to further undermine the Jewish state of Israel in its death struggle, literally, with a terrorist group called Hamas and other Sharia supremacist enemies with which it is aligned.
Right. Well, I think the first thing that people need to understand is, you know, what Hamas is, to focus on them for a moment, which is an Islamic terrorist organization that basically controls the Gaza Strip. It means they have their own terrorist nation, and they are dedicated explicitly to the construction of the Jewish state and to the genocide of the Jewish people. So in that context, we have Hamas attacking Israel, raining thousands of rockets down on Israel, and a Biden administration who's sending money to the Palestinians even while this is going on. In fact, in the midst of this barrage, announced recently the next tranche of money they're sending to the Palestinians, while simultaneously dragging its feet on whether or not it will resupply the missile batteries that the Israelis are using to keep these rockets from reaching their intended targets. So we have an administration that has come down firmly on the side of a terrorist group against one of our staunchest allies in the world. That's where we are.
You know, apropos to that point, I would ask you, Sam Faddis, as a former career intelligence professional, the fact that there is a very aggressive Palestinian activist now sitting in the job of the director of intelligence for the National Security Council, a fellow by the name of Mehar Bityar, I would assume is contributing to, if not greatly exacerbating, the pro-Palestinian sentiments and anti-Israel policies of the Biden administration. Would that be right?
Yeah, without question. And I think it's really important for people to understand here that what we're talking about is what we are talking about are Palestinian terrorists. There can't be a way to put it. That doesn't mean I'm characterizing every Palestinian on the face of Earth as a terrorist. I'm saying what we have, going back to Hamas, is an explicitly terrorist organization has rejected all attempts to make peace and could not be more vulgar and direct in their advocating for literally the extermination of the Jewish people, the kind of stuff you would have expected to come out of the mouth of Adolf Hitler. So, you know, to stand anywhere within 100 miles of that organization and its ideology is just great. Grotesque, and yet that's where we are. That's what we have. We have an American administration taking the side of a designated terrorist organization,
and as you say, actually enabling its activities by sending the Palestinians money, and some of it unquestionably is migrating into the hands of Hamas. Let me ask you, Sam. You've spent some time in some pretty unsavory places dealing with insurgencies. Is what Israel is now confronting inside Israel proper from Israeli Arabs rising to that level of problem? It's being described as an intifada, but isn't that essentially Arabic for an insurgency?
Without question. I mean, we've seen it before, and that's what we're seeing now. Rockets happen to be the weapon of choice right now. Let's keep in mind that Hamas is engaged in make a list of every horrific type of terrorist attack you could engage in, and Hamas has engaged in those in the past and will in the future. We are talking about people who slaughter men, women, children, blow up buses, rain rockets into neighborhoods. These rockets are not precision-guided weapons being launched at military installations. These are weapons that go up in the air, land somewhere in a general vicinity, and are designed to do one thing: kill average people on the street. Your kids walk into school, that's the objective.
But beyond the rockets, what I'm talking about are the pogroms. I'm talking about the murderous attacks in Jewish communities, or in fact, in simply cities in which both Arabs and Jews reside. This seems to me to be a horse of a different color from what we've seen before, if I can use that expression, and a very malevolent turn of events. Don't
yeah, and let's keep in mind that it occurs against the backdrop of what the Trump administration was doing, which was facilitating very, very effectively peace agreements between one Arab state after another with Israel. We had really turned the corner and were moving toward a completely different era in the Middle East. A stability, peace, things people would never contemplate. And now we have turned that all around, and we are back to the era of terrorism and death. And we got a White House who is really facilitating this. I mean, is the reality. That's
encouraging
the
it. Yeah, I'm afraid. And we're watching this as some of those Arab nations are now finding they have to distance themselves from Israel. It's just unbelievable, incredibly tragic. And to think that it's all happened in the space of 100 days or so is truly mind-boggling. Sam Faddis, let me turn to one other topic that you've addressed recently at AND Magazine. We are increasingly given to understand that the Wuhan virus, as it's been called, I think of it as the CCP or Chinese Communist Party virus, did indeed emanate from a virology institute in that city tied to the PLA, the People's Liberation Army, and its biological weapons program. What has only recently begun to get attention is the role that Anthony Fauci, the man we're told is the great hero of this effort to contend with that disease, may have been responsible for its production, at the very least, in that laboratory. What do we know about that, and what should be the takeaway?
Well, I mean, we know that Fauci, back 2015, circa that time frame, the Obama administration, to its credit, I should say, decreed that we were shutting off all U.S. government funding to what's called gain-of-function research, which shorthand means making viruses more dangerous. And that despite that, Fauci came up with a series of end-arounds, including funneling money through a private entity to continue to send funding to the Wuhan lab, explicitly tied, clearly tied to gain-of-function research. The entire purpose of the research that was ongoing there was gain-of-function. He knew that, and he continued to fund it, and he did it, as you've indicated, knowing not just that they were playing with fire, but that the Chinese have a bioweapons program, that part of that program is focused on exactly this gain-of-function research, and that there were military researchers in that Wuhan lab to which he was sending money. So he was not only helping pay to make viruses more dangerous, specifically coronaviruses, but knowing that that information was going into the possession of our number one adversary on the face of the earth and one with an explicit desire to use bioweapons against us. And then we know, of course, that he showed up and lied to Rand Paul about all of it.
This would seem to me to fit the definition of treason. I'm not quite sure if I'm misinterpreting anything you've said, but when you look at the danger that this entails, to say nothing of the actual loss of life of, what is it now, 50,000 plus Americans? To say nothing of millions of people elsewhere around the world, it is simply outrageous, not just mind-boggling, but outrageous that an individual should both have done this and be lionized as he has been by the media, by successive administrations. What's to be done about this evidence in terms of, holding Tony Fauci personally, specifically accountable for it?
Well, I mean, in a perfect world, Fauci would be under criminal investigation by the Federal Bureau of Investigation right now, and there are probably 100 different federal statutes under which he could be charged. Right now, at a minimum, I would hope to God that the U.S. Senate is going to dig into this and launch some sort of formal inquiry. It is, as you say, mind-boggling, particularly not that he did this, which is staggering the more you look at it, but that then somehow this guy, who, as I think Senator Paul has noted, is really at the heart of the origin of the pandemic, and now puts himself out there as our savior. Yeah, I helped fund all of the work that led to this, but now you should trust me to get you out of it. That takes your breath away.
It does. That dog won't hunt, as they say. Sam Faddis, we have to leave it at that. Thanks for joining us. Come back to us again soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.